Time now for the weekly Middle East report with Hafiza Rehana Umar. And today we are looking at Iraq and Palestine. Hafiza Rehana, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And assalamu alaikum to your listeners.
Yesterday marked 13 years since war crimes of incredible proportions were committed during the invasion of Iraq. And for the most of the part, the mental health crisis in the country continues to go by neglected. Tell us more about that.
That's right. We know that Iraqis went through a lot of decades of war and dictatorship. First it was the Iran-Iraq War, and then the Gulf Wars, two of them, Saddam Hussein's tyranny, and then there was all of the invasion that took place 13 years ago when it began, and now the Islamic State group that's terrorizing people in Iraq, according to many. When we look at what Iraqis have had to face, and in cases of war situation, the humanitarian priority for first responders is to deal with what they can see, and that's food, shelter, and medical care issues. So it's not surprising that psychological and mental health has been put back onto the back burner. And now, more than 30 years later, with all of these wars, and especially the invasion of Iraq 13 years ago, that has led to incredible consequences, where people are left with psychological issues and scarring that has not been dealt with, and that's then been placed onto generation after generation. The Amar Foundation began in 1991 and tried to set up clinics to deal with the trauma of the war. But of course, once they got over one war, they entered into another, and that's how it's been. Nowadays, nearly one in five Iraqis suffer from mental health issues, and it's actually become like an epidemic, where we would probably talk about the flu or about a virus, a stomach bug. In Iraq, mental health issues have been stigmatized for so long. Genocide, war has led to all of this, and the hardship. Remember, right now, there's more than 3.3 million Iraqis displaced within Iraq itself. So these are the bigger issues that they have at hand, and unfortunately, issues about mental health awareness have been left out completely. So when we talk about history, and very often we talk about that here on the report on Mondays, we need to remember and acknowledge the psychological impacts of the war, and that the trauma of this conflict has brought to adults and children and the elderly, and the thousands that were victims of chemical warfare during Saddam Hussein's time. So as we will be hearing media and witnessing media write and talk about 13 years on from Iraq's invasion, let's not forget that for people on the ground, the daily trauma, stress, fear, anxiety, depression, all of this cannot be denied, and that they are victims of abuse and victims of trauma beyond what many of us can even begin to try to understand. So yes, 13 years later, trauma of the psychological and mental health issues are key, what we need to understand in Iraq itself.
It's important what you raise, and just speaking about mental health crisis, early on during last week we heard about the Palestinian teacher nominated as the best teacher in the world, and she speaks about how she was actually educating the children who were coming from a war-torn region, and how they were finding it difficult to psychologically grasp information, etc., and how she had to change the tactic. So relating it to Iraq makes a lot of sense, and what you just pointed out is quite amazing. How are the kids in particular managing?
Well, kids have everything from the basic symptoms of bedwetting to becoming delinquent and choosing not to attend school or have studies, suffering depression because of parents that have been killed or gone missing during many of the wars. The sense of family identity is lost, Molana. And one example that's been going around in social media for about 2 years now is of an Iraqi child lying down on a cold cemented floor and drawing a picture or an outline of a picture next to him and saying that that's his mother, wishing that that parent was there. That was a very powerful, profound impact and image. But, you mentioned about the children and how they're impacted, and I hear of it from a first-hand point from my son at his school. He's at an Arab school, and in his classroom, he's got children that are refugees from almost every Arab country of the world. Mm-hmm. And when he talks about how they scarred and how they, and as teenagers, when they talk about the war and the bitterness that's there, the confusion that's there, and some of them just burst out crying in class. We're talking about children who are 14, 15 years old, and how it impacts and affects them. And you know, that they're afraid when their family calls from back home because they're not sure what news they're going to receive. So we can just then imagine those that are in a war crime and a war situation, those in Iraq who for over 30 years are experiencing war of some sort or the other. And you know, you're brought up feeling that things are so unfair for you, and you're left bitter or confused and completely traumatized, being unable to school or to study or to live a normal life. So yes, the children are the ones who suffer the most, and they're the first casualty of war.
Mm-hmm. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala ease in the plight of all those who are suffering. Let's move on. 5 months ago, Jordan and Israel agreed on the installation of cameras inside Al-Aqsa Mosque. Any updates from that?
Yes, you know, when they set out with this plan 5 months ago, last year, October, initially the Zionist government were very... we were against this, completely against this. They felt that it should be on their terms. They regarded and called it, as they still do, the so-called Temple Mount, and said that when the Palestinian Waqf Committee began installing the cameras in October last year, they created a huge hoo-ha and had international agencies come in and sit down and negotiate, and these cameras were then removed. And the reason for the cameras being installed or tried to be previously, as in now as well, is to monitor extremist Jews, the Zionists, and the Israeli police, who are oppressing people, who are injuring them, men, women, children, who are not allowing people to worship inside Aqsa, but also recently Zionists who have been desecrating Masjid al-Aqsa itself. And as Muslims, our belief being that it's not just the masjid that's sacred, but the entire sanctuary and area itself. So finally, it's now being decided, and it will go ahead. A Jordanian company will install cameras in Masjid al-Aqsa this week. And preparations have been undertaken. The Israeli government has no role in it. Jordan, who are regarded as the official custodians of the Third Haram, will pay for the work to be done. The cameras would then allow everyone to see Masjid al-Aqsa, to see what is happening and whether there is violation and how Palestinians are provoked by the settlers within Masjid al-Aqsa. On another note, on the media front, it may also mean that we will have greater coverage and an opportunity to see more of the Salah being beamed out live from the Aqsa Masjid. Not much more about that, but we're hopeful that the cameras will allow for us to be able to see, as we do Mecca and Medina, you know, 5 times a day and 24 hours a day, live camera footage. So perhaps hoping for that to come out from Masjid al-Aqsa as well.
Wonderful stuff indeed. Your recommended piece for the week?
It comes to us from the website yourmiddleeast.com. And it's an article, it's a brief history of Arabic literature in China. It's fascinating because it gives an overview of the movement of Arabic literature into Chinese. Now, the relationship between China and the Arabic writing world has been existing for more than 2,000 years. It goes back to the Ming and Qing dynasties. An amazing work that has been done, the literature translations, poems, novels, the works of writers like Najib Mahfouz, Edward Said, and besides that, of course, more important to us is the translations of many of the Qasidas, Qasida Burda, which was translated more than 300 years ago, the Quran being translated, Arabic poetry and literature being translated over the years. The 1930s was the most fascinating period where there was plenty of translation happening, and it also talks about the role of translation from Arabic literature into Chinese during the early period of the People's Republic of China up until the more recent times. So for your listeners that are interested to know more about the Arabic literature and the progression of translation into other languages, this article featured on yourmiddleeast.com will be very fascinating indeed. I will be tweeting on it after this, so the links will be available.
Officer Rehana, as always, Jazakumullah khairan for your time. Much appreciated.
You're most welcome. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's 7:33. You are listening to Sabah al-Muslim on Radio Islam International.